The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Why don't we start with number one? Representative Abler, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I appreciate taking up this matter. This is actually, I don't spend a lot of time in front of your committee, which I consider to be a blessing, but it's nice to be here today. But this is, in the matters I brought before, there's a lot of policy debate, and this is a true policy question here, and I think both parties come here seeking the good determination on the part of the commission as to what proper treatment of this employee is. And so
okay. Why don't we have the pension commission staff quickly review?
Exactly. And so that's my whole opening comments, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. So thank you.
Mr. Martin.
Okay, members, this relates to an individual who until recently was the golf professional and the pro shop manager at the Greenhaven Golf Course in the city of Anoka. And for a good period of the time that he spent in that endeavor, he was characterized as an independent contractor, did not become a member of PERA until 1998, although his service in some capacity started as far back as the late 1970s. And the issue here is whether he was properly characterized as an independent contractor for much of his career, and if he was not properly characterized as an independent contractor, then he should have been a member of PERA going back a considerable period of time and wants to purchase that service credit. So mostly you're looking at the issue of whether he was working in the capacity of an independent contractor or as an employee. And there are a number of factors that go to that odd determination. There are some items in your packet related to how the Internal Revenue Service looks at independent contractors and whether they're properly classified. The federal government has been cracking down on independent contractor determinations, and that apparently is why Mr. Bendix, who's the individual involved here, was shifted to being a PERA member back in 1998. With that, members, I'd be happy to answer questions. I'm sure PERA has something to add, and the city undoubtedly has something to add, as well as Mr. Bendix.
Okay. Mr. Bendix, did you want to add anything at this point? You'll have another chance, but after you hear what the city...
Not at this point.
Okay. Why don't we hear then from PERA and the city? Sir?
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Tim Cruikshank, the city manager from the city of Anoka. And if
okay.
it's appropriate, I'll speak now. Or if you
okay.
want
to, go ahead.
Okay. Very good. I believe handouts have been distributed. And I won't take a lot of your time going through this. The first document that I would draw your attention to is entitled Written Submission by the City of Anoka to the Proposed Legislation. This is a document from our attorney outlining the reasons why we believe that Mr. Bendix was an independent contractor and not a city employee. Okay. I'm not going to go through this portion of the memo. I believe it's Perez's position that, in fact, he was a city employee. We're not going to challenge that. We're going to accept that, and we're going to move on to, I think, a different, more substantial point, if we could. And so in that regard, what I'd like to do is move to page 2 of this memo in the very bottom, Roman numeral number 3, where it talks about retaining compensation. It has been indicated that cities may only expend funds for a public purpose under item Roman numeral 3A, and we're questioning what is a valid public purpose regarding compensation. What I would do then is draw your attention to this matrix. I believe this was handed out as well. And the years that I'd like to focus on are the years 1984 through 1997. In those years, the assistant golf professional and golf professional is what Mr. Bendix was. The city did pay an annual salary that we believe is competitive, would have been competitive in the market at that time and was competitive through the years that he was the golf professional. And that's his annual salary. There was other income that was earned at that time. Other income included revenue from pro shop merchandise, sales from tournaments, golf lessons, pull carts, rental clubs, and water balls. We have a concern legally, first of all, whether or not that's even appropriate for an employee to earn that compensation. The second point, then, is if it's determined that that is okay, we believe that this employee then was adequately compensated, and that portion of the income could very well be the pair payment if it's determined that there needs to be some back pay or back compensation to make him whole as far as para is concerned. I'll stop with that and answer more specific questions if that's not clear.
Other income is on top of the annual salary amount?
That's correct.
And what's the two columns here, annual salary in Anoka County Golf Club? What's that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we're trying to indicate is that the annual salary that the city paid to Mr. Bendix is very comparable, and the example that we used is the Anoka County Golf Course Chamonix. And you'll see in 1992, they paid their golf pro $33,000. We paid ours a little more than that, and so on.
Is the Anoka County person covered by PERA?
We assumed so.
At that time, I don't think so, but
we're using this as our market comparison.
Okay. And what happened in 1998 that generated the PERA?
In 1998, because of the question of his status, the city did make Mr. Bendix a city employee and paid him that annual salary that's indicated in the column there under city employee, and at that time did not pay additional income or other compensation, but did pay para.
And what precipitated was there a letter from somebody that said you can't be doing it this way, or what actually happened to get to where you are with PERA coverage?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members, I was not with the city at that time. It's my understanding that there was an audit done, and it was the recommendation of either the auditor or a representative from the IRS or someone who thought this would be the best way to go.
Okay. PERA, Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA. When Mr. Bendix was enrolled in PERA, the membership application did indicate that he had previously been an independent contractor. Our staff did not pursue any clarification of that. We have since time reviewed the contracts, and it is the assessment of our staff that had we looked at them, we would have determined that although some of the compensation arrangements for these side additional compensation were not something that we would deem compensation for an employee, the control that the city exercised and the specified job duties that were defined as an addendum or an appendix to the contract certainly would have, in our view, deemed him to be an employee. Had this inquiry been made when he was initially enrolled in 1998, we could have gone back 3 years to collect admitted deductions, but we could not have gone all the way back. The bottom line is that the staff looked at these contracts and said, with all this additional income and control that he had in the pro shop, the lessons, the receipt of the prize money, is not something that you would typically see within the receipt of an employee of a city. And so they were torn as to where to fall on this issue. But specifically looking at the terms of the contracts, control that the city continued to exercise over the golf course as an integral part of the Parks and Recreation Program, the para staff deemed that this would have been an employment relationship rather than independent contractor.
And is this a year-round position or just
yes.
During the summer months? Or
Year-round.
What's a golf professional do in December in Minnesota? Just a curiosity.
Well, in the winter months, Mr. Chairman, the golf pro would be responsible for having meetings with city in our case, park boards, golf subcommittees, city manager, finance department, you know, you get ready for the following season as far as what you're going to charge for rates, what other golf courses are doing and what they're planning on charging. There's merchandise to order, tournaments, leagues, and such, planning for the upcoming season that is ongoing all winter long.
Okay. Questions, members?
In it, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bendix.
In one thing that's important when I first started looking into this situation, obviously the IRS 20 question situation obviously determines the employer independent contractor difference. In my checking, I checked around at other cities at that time that had municipal golf courses during the same period of time. Turned out that the city of Rochester had three public golf courses, and the city of Coon Rapids and the city of Becker all had public golf courses in the same situation that we were. And in all those situations, the city of Rochester, they had a golf pro, Frank Taylor, Jake Monahan, and Tim Higgins. The golf courses were Soldiers Field, Northern Hills, and Eastview. Dick Tillett at Bunker Hill, City of Coon Rapids, George Shortridge at Pebble Creek, City of Becker. In all those situations, the golf professional got a salary from, as I did, from the city of Anoka. They also owned the merchandise, as I did, as part of their pay. And also, in the case of Rochester, three golf courses, this person also owned the golf cart revenue. But in all five cases, in all the cities here, they all were paid city benefits on the salary, not the other compensation. And at this time, one of those is retired. They got PER benefits, and all five did through that same period of time with the same like situation as mine.
So do we – so other like situation – how about – Minneapolis has a – are they PERA pensions, the Minneapolis people?
Mr. Chair, I wouldn't know without knowing their names and looking them up in the system. The individuals that Mr. Bendix refers to, I did look up. They were enrolled in PERA initially. There was a survey done by the city of Anoka, and I didn't bring that chart with me, but they had indicated that in their limited survey that it was kind of split 50-50. Some of them were treated as independent contractors. Some of them were treated as city employees. It really was the relationship defined by the city. I'd also like to point out one other clarification here. The staff refers to going back into the 1970s. The calculations that we prepared on the cost to allow Mr. Bendix to get credit was only done back to March 1st of 1984. Based on my conversation with him, he didn't know for sure, but thought that perhaps his earlier service may have been part-time or limited in earnings, and that's why he wouldn't have qualified for para. We did not back up to verify that. So the calculation we have done goes back to March 1st, 1984 through 1997 to account for the years for which a contract does exist. So if there's additional service to be added, we'll have to redo our calculations.
And why don't you just go through that cost? What did you calculate? This on page 3, I think, of the memo.
I didn't understand that.
My cheat sheet in front of me. We calculated that to add the additional 13 years and 10 months of service would increase Mr. Bendix's benefit from $15.13 a month to $36.59 a month at age 66, which includes deferred interest or deferred augmentation. The present value of the benefit is estimated to be $69,257 that would have to be paid to PERA. However, the contributions in total is $90,334 under the 356551 calculation procedure. So we would expect the $90,334 payment with some of that to be paid by Mr. Bendix. His contributions were calculated to be $50,818 roughly, and the city would be responsible for the difference between the 90 and the 50, as we understand the procedure.
Cost of benefits.
Okay.
What did he have to pay?
I think we just heard two different things. One is the examples that Mr. Bendix gave us were all PERA employees. There's a group out there that he did not talk about that are not PERA employees. Who are they? Where are they, roughly? Are they different counties do it a different way, or different cities do it a different way? Or
Mr. Chair, different cities did it different ways. And some of them did truly treat their golf pros as independent contractors and did not enroll them in PERA. Many of them, however, treated them as employees.
Is the past tense what's important under the IRS ruling? Is everybody now treated, in this circumstance, now treated as a PERA employee?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that for a fact either. What we do is, I do know that we have a procedure defined in our employer reporting manual, and we encourage employers to contact us if they're entering into an independent contractor arrangement. So we can identify this up front. But whether they all do, I don't know.
Mr. Chair, no. I know for a fact that not all golf pros in the public environment, in a working for a golf course owned by a public jurisdiction, they are not all treated as public employees. And
Even today.
There are situations where there are current independent contract employees out there.
What creates that difference for the IRS?
That's a technical question I don't know the answer to, and I think some of that is why we're here today, is that it's very fuzzy.
Senator Fetzel? Ms. Vanek, do you have something on that point?
Mr. Chair, there's a series of questions that are given primary and secondary consideration in determining whether an individual is an independent contractor or an employee. And generally, if you can answer no to the majority of these questions in terms of whether or not they are one or the other, we will say that there these particular questions, if the majority of the answers are no, we say then they're an employee. And we certainly don't have any special expertise on this, but we look for the degree of control that the employer has over the operations of the particular area that individual is involved with, and whether or not the individual has others who are reporting to him or her that are considered city employees or are considered employees of that individual's business. So those are some pretty significant features. The control is the degree of control over the budget of the entity, the activities that this individual engages in is pretty significant, okay. Usually in deeming an employee rather than contractor.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I was just noting the memo that I guess that Anoka, the city of Anoka provided, page 2 indicates that they had found that Edina, Golden Valley, Invergrove Heights, and Richfield had characterized apparently their positions as independent contractors, at least in 1996. Later on, this memo does talk about, though, Mr. Bendix receiving compensation that would have been illegal had he been an employee. And it doesn't give additional information. I just wonder if we could get that. What compensation was he given that would have been
Chair,
illegal?
Mr. Chair, Member Betzold, in the matrix that was handed out, okay. The spreadsheet. Some of the other income that we're referring to is the sale of the pro shop merchandise, sales from tournaments, golf lessons, pull carts, rental clubs, and water balls. That's all revenue and income above and beyond that base salary, and we do have a concern about that.
And, Mr. Chair, it's illegal because if he would be paid as an employee, he would not be allowed to be moonlighting, or he would not be allowed this compensation. You cited an attorney general's opinion and so forth. What could you be a little bit more specific as to where the conflict is here?
In my mind, if Mr. Bendix was a city employee, he would have earned a salary plus benefits like every other city employee, not a salary plus an opportunity to earn above and beyond that.
Okay, thank you.
With use of the public facility. That's obviously, public employees can have other jobs if they choose, but you meant with use of the position,
yes,
to earn income.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, yes, Mr. Bendix. No, make it clear. No one here thinks you were doing anything wrong.
Oh, I know.
We're just trying to figure out the difference here. Go ahead.
Just in comment reference to the fact that other cities offer, have independent contracts with other golf pros. I did a lot of checking at the time when I started looking into this, and at that time, not many cities had public golf courses at that time. And I checked extensively, and I did not find any other public golf course that had a person in my situation that had an independent contract. And the question in this particular case is the other compensation, if you, and I'm looking at the 1988 contract, one of the things that the city provided in the contract as other compensation was 1% of gross sales at the end of the 1988 season. As far as the merchandise stuff, other compensation, that is just, that's part of the salary, but that's not the question as far as whether you're an employee or a independent contractor. And like I say, in the situations that I did find, the situation was exactly the same as my situation. And as far as I know, there aren't, I don't know of any golf courses right now that have too many independent contracts. I think that's, in this day and age, it's not that way.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions of the city manager, Mr. Cruikshank. So am I clear on this? The city of Anoka's position is that this man was not an employee prior to 1998?
That is correct. That is the position that we did have during the time of this arrangement.
Mr. Cruikshank, thank you. You answered that question. Then I would ask you, if that was your position, why did the city of Anoka issue him an employee number for his service prior to 1998 throughout his time at the golf course, which seems to have extended back to 1978 part-time and then full-time in 1982? In short, then, why did the city give him an employee number if he was not an employee?
Mr. Chair, I would agree that the relationship was confused. I believe that there's evidence that indicates that he was treated as an employee, but there's also evidence that indicates that he was not an employee. I don't have a better answer than that because I was not around at the time, and I think that that does get to the heart of the issue, is that there is documentation, practices, the way Mr. Bendix in this case was treated that seemed like he was an employee.
You are around now and you're the city manager. Does the city of Anoka give employee numbers to people who are not employees of the city?
No.
Also, Mr. Cruikshank, the packet that I'm looking at references a memorandum in 1998 referencing sick and vacation leave accruals given to Mr. Bendix, sick and vacation leave accruals equal to the averages of city employees with 10 years of employment. What that tells me in my reading is that 1998, he was given something referencing a prior 10 years of employment by the city. So is it the city's position that prior to 1998 for 10 years that he was in the employment of the city?
The indication of that would be that yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wardley.
One clarification. Under the column annual salary, from is that a combination of employee salary from the city and other income, or is other income, it says yes. Is that not listed?
Other incomes above that.
Okay, so above you're seeking, what you're seeking only pertains to the column under annual salary, not the additional.
Correct. In the case of the other cities that have the golf courses that I mentioned, that's the way the situation, they were paid ERA benefits and full city benefits just based on the salary part, not the other compensation.
And one more. On page 2, column A, where it talks about, it questions whether or not a golf pro services is a general value for public purpose. I guess that's part of the question, because if you don't think it's a public service to have a golf pro at a golf course, the city has an argument, and if you think you are necessary, people do like, I guess, to have a golf pro available, then you are a public service. To what extent that has a bearing on our decision, I'm not sure, but I just noticed that one of your arguments is you don't consider being a golf pro as a public service. But based on what Representative Smith questioned, he's got a good argument against the city, I think.
Representative Thiessen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify on this, that 1998 memo, the way I read this, what they're saying is that you didn't pay any benefits before 98, you started paying benefits in 98, and you just started the calculation as you mentioned, basically in the negotiations with Mr. Bendix as to what your benefits are going to be, and you pick an equivalent of someone who's been around for 10 years. That doesn't necessarily say to me that you considered him to be an employee 10 years prior to that. Am I getting that right?
Mr. Chair, that would be accurate, but because he did have years of service in a relationship with the city when it was negotiated at that time, it felt fair to give some credit for that.
But that was just a negotiated deal.
That's right.
Is the city's position that you really don't want to come up with the 40,000? I don't mean this cynically, but is it the 40,000 that's the issue for the city, or is it the employment relationship that's the issue for the city? The employment relationship is different from 98 on. Is that the point you're trying to make, or you really prefer not to come up with this 40,000?
Mr. Chair.
And I don't mean that cynically. I'm trying to get a sense.
I understand. The city's position is we want to do what's fair and right, and I think that this is a gray area. It's a very complicated area. The city took the position that Mr. Bendix was a contract employee, and because of that, we didn't pay him para. Mr. Smith indicated that there were factual reasons as to how and why the city treated him as an employee. There are other factual reasons that indicated how the city treated Mr. Bendix as a contract employee. In that, we had an agreement with him, unlike other employees, that indicated that he was not an employee. And there are other factors like that. So it's the city's position that we want to do what is fair and best and right. Furthermore, I would add that this is more a matter of what's equitable and fair. Other employees are paid a salary based on the market compared with other cities for the service that they provide to the community. And had that been the case with Mr. Bendix, he would not have had a chance to earn above and beyond what's indicated in the annual salary column.
Are the other employees at the golf course public employees, or are they contractual employees at that time?
They're public employees, and most of them were seasonals, if not all of them.
Okay. So they would not likely have been PERA covered?
No.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bendix.
I'm looking at in 1998 when they made me in a contract employee, the golf course professional manager, which is what this job was, and all the people, the degree of control is implemented here in a golf course operations organizational structure. Starts off with the superintendent of parks, recreation, and maintenance as the head person running the golf course or the department. Underneath that would be the golf course professional manager, which is me. Under that, on the other side, is the golf course superintendent. Under us, of course, is other employees that I supervise on the golf shop side. And the golf course superintendent or groundskeeper had his employees underneath him. The thing in question here is that, as Mr. Cruickshank says, is that in many ways I was an employee. And I supervised, employees under me that were all, every one of them was a city employee except me. And the other employees that worked in the department were all city employees. Nobody was a contract employee. So the test here is the IRS test that the 20 questions that you have in your packet that determines an independent contractor versus an employee. I can answer, in my opinion, yes to all 20 questions in the scope of my job and the degree of control the city had over my work. And in the decision thing here, if you can answer yes to one of those questions out of the 20, you would be considered an employee as opposed to an independent contractor.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bendix, several times you've used the phrase when I first started looking into this. Could you clarify when you first started looking into this?
I believe in 2001, I called PERA and talked to Mrs. Vanek and asked about my situation as to thinking that at that time I wasn't an independent contractor. And at that time, Mrs. Vanek was outside the three-year statute of limitation. And at that time, they just called me back and said that the city considered me an independent contractor. Then about a year later, I called back and talked to her again, and I went and visited her personally and explained when I found out the fact that the IRS, or governmental agency, had gone to the city in an audit and questioned whether I was an independent contractor. And at that time, the governmental agency determined that I was not an independent contractor, I was an employee. So I asked her if that would make any difference in checking into the situation. At that time, she told me about the process of this commission on pensions and retirement and directed me to contact Senator Betzold. At that time, I did, and Senator Betzold gave me the thought it would be best for me to contact one of my local representatives, Representative Abler, which I did. And in talking to Representative Abler, in my question of this independent contractor employee status, his recommendation to me was at the time to get some more information or details as to whether I was wrong in this situation. At that time, I ended up finding out about the other golf courses owned by Rochester and the city of Coon Rapids and Becker, and found that my situation was just like those, and in that situation felt that I had been wrong. Then at that time I found the article in the paper concerning what you have in your packet. It was put in a magazine, Golf Range Times, employee or independent contract, ? And in that there's many things based on determining it. So at that point, I went back to Representative Abler, who at that point, then I had an avenue that for my case, and then he set me up to go see Larry Martin, and that's how. And that was last year, okay. You know, about a year ago.
And so in the 80s and the 90s, up to 98, during that time, you felt that you were an independent contractor and you were paying into your own pension or whatever?
No, at that time, when I first got hired when I was younger, I obviously didn't know laws, or I trusted the city staff, HR department, or legal staff that if they were going to call me an independent contractor, then they obviously knew what they were doing. That was fine by me. I didn't know what independent contractor meant. I didn't know anything about retirement at that time. I just trusted that what they were doing was proper at that time. Okay. Until I found out in 2001 that the things that had occurred.
But excuse me, Mr. Chair, Mr. Bendix, in your conversations when you were negotiating your independent contract, did you discuss pensions at all? The money that you were getting, and so much of a certain percentage or whatever was for pension?
At that time, I didn't really even pay attention to pensions.
Okay.
I was young at that time, and I didn't understand anything about pensions at that time.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bendix, just one more question. That in 1975 and 76, you worked for the city of Anoka, and you paid into PERA, and the city paid into PERA. Did you leave that money in PERA? Is that money still there for 1975 and then 1976?
It's in there now. Yeah.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, the bill, proposed bill in the file, I would like to move that.
Okay. Yep. Representative Smith moves the bill as drafted. Council, suggestions on the draft or other comments?
Members, I do want to point out, if you turn to page one of the draft, normally we try and specify the period of a purchase fairly specifically. In this case, because there's some confusion about just when Mr. Bendix became had the status of a public employee under PERA law, if you look at lines 1.10 and 1.11, the language is vague. Whatever PERA determines would have been constituting public employment under PERA law is what you're authorizing him to purchase, and that would be a determination that would be made based on the facts.
Ms. Vanek, it sounded like you were comfortable with going back to 84, or is that incorrect?
Yes, March 1st, 1984 was his initial contract.
And that went from seasonal to contractual, and from PERA's perspective, there is a difference there.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
In terms of number of hours. And 84, was it full-time? In 84?
Yes. You're
and 84 seems like a long time ago, doesn't
yes,
it? $9,000 for full-time. Well, I guess it was full-time. So, okay, so I think, Representative Smith, you'd like it drafted so it was to that date, March 1st, 84?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Could I ask, I'm sure you don't remember the exact amounts, but the other income during these years, would this double this amount or 25% it or just ballpark?
I'm going to say maybe 10 to 20%.
Okay.
I don't know.
Does that sound about right to the city?
Yeah, our records indicate that gross revenues were anywhere from $5,000 a year to $20,000 a year, which equates, you know, net income to something less than that, of course.
Okay. So it's not that the other income was the real job.
Right.
Right. The bulk of the compensation was here. And, okay, did you pay taxes on it? Okay.
I'll have to answer that.
Yeah, you don't have to answer that. Just would make me feel a little better. So, Ms. Vanek, if we were to move with the Smith motion and that became law, does that create other issues as you can see it? Or give us, from PERA's perspective, what's the potential repercussions of that?
Well, Mr. Chair, we're certainly going to want to find out a little bit more about what golf course employees throughout the state are treated as independent contractors versus employees and dig into that a little further. This is a perennial issue for the pension system and for the commission. I remember when I first started working at the legislative level of my job, we had an individual who definitely was an independent contractor, and we wanted to kick him out, but he came to the legislature and wanted to stay in, and he was allowed to stay in. So we have it, we continually struggle back and forth. The one thing that I can say, and I'd like to assure the commission, that since that time in the early 1990s, we have put together a very specific brochure that we distribute to employers, a check sheet on the questions that the IRS looks to determine independent contractor versus employee, and directions in our employer manual. We encourage employers to submit contracts to us in advance so we don't have to have you facing these retroactive perspectives. We don't get full cooperation in that regard. Oftentimes employees will come to us and say, I don't really think I'm supposed to be an independent contractor, and we continue to work out those issues. But we are taking every step we can to try to make sure you don't see more cases like this.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vanek, do you have any comments to make about number 6 on page 3 of the staff memo?
Well, that really goes to the heart of what I just commented to. We really are doing our best. I had a lengthy discussion with the manager of the division that oversees employer reporting and membership enrollment, and we are going to see how we can, if possible, step this up in our exclusion report. We're doing some data analysis on how many people are reported as independent contractors, but keep in mind that means we may have to hire more staff, increases our administrative expenses, because this is analytical work. This isn't computer work that you can, you know, you need a more skilled individual if we're going to really step up this audit. But we recognize the fact that we do have a responsibility to look at it more closely when we know there are independent contractor arrangements out there.
Representative Thiessen.
Just one other kind of more specific question. Do you remember before 1998 if you got a W-2 from the city or a Form 1099? Maybe this came up earlier.
Sorry.
That did not.
1099.
Is that a factor in PERA's determination which forms are being used or not really?
Mr. Chair, if the city truly deemed him to be an independent contractor, that's correct tax reporting form. If they would have given him a W-2, that would have been a big, you know, heads up to the IRS right away.
Okay.
So
how did the IRS ultimately kind of intervene here?
Do you know?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bendix asked them to look at it or what? And that would be fine. I'm just curious. Do they go around looking for this, or how does that happen?
You've got better insight on this than I do.
Mr. Bendix?
Bear with me.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment while he's looking. I do know that there was a period of time where we were contacted by an IRS compliance auditor who was looking at various local government entities to determine whether or not people were being appropriately characterized as employees or independent contractors. So we had this call to our attention in a couple of different situations.
And this was one of the job classes, or it was all related around this job class?
No, Mr. Chair, it was in various. It was. They were looking specifically at independent contractor arrangements.
Mr. Chairman, I have found what I'm looking for in the article that was in the magazine. According to Tax Savvy for Small Business, year-round tax strategies to save you money by Frederick W. Daly. The Wall Street Journal reported that in 1 6-year period, the IRS performed more than 11,000 audits of companies using independent contractors. The results, 483,000 reclassifications of independent contractors to employee status and $751 million in back taxes and penalties. And that was at the time when this audit took place, and which is why the IRS reclassified me as an employee, and that's why the city did that at that time.
Okay, we have the Smith motion before us. If I could just ask the city, if this commission and the legislature decide that based on what they understand, this would be the right thing or equitable thing to do, is that something the city can live with, or will the city view this as an injustice perpetrated upon them to pay $40,000? And I'm just trying to get a feel for if there's something here we don't totally understand about this situation.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate
that. Is there something we
question.
Don't know here?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I've not run this past the city council, and I find it hard to believe that they would be so outraged that they would make a big issue out of this. However, we still believe that this employee will have been overcompensated if he had otherwise been a city employee.
Understand. Okay, we have the Smith motion. Discussion? All for incorporation into the omnibus. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion adopted, I believe. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you for your
Mr. Bendix,
work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the Commission.
Okay, we have some members here.
You might be right.
I think Houseman has probably got the most seniority. Whoops.
Item 1 on the agenda.
No, she doesn't. Solberg? Sure, if you're ready. Do I have that right? Does Solberg have a little more seniority?
I think he does.
Oh. Yeah, but Sachs.
I didn't know we went on seniority here.
Well, we just, since there are people waiting and stuff, we try to be as respectful as we can. You're from out of state also, so.
No, we're not from out of state. We're
all right.
Out of state. Greater Minnesota. I should probably not have corrected you.
No, you're correct. You're correct. Go ahead. This is number 4. I apologize.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over to Senator Saxog.
Well, we'll have staff
go through.
Tell us what the piece of legislation
I'll just
does.
Introduce us.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, we are presenting here Senate File 46 and House File 64. And this bill will allow a former Itasca County probation officer to repurchase or refund. With me today is Linda Ross, that former Itasca County employee and probation officer, and I thought she might describe her situation, but she can probably answer questions, and as you say, staff will go.
Yes.
Thank you.
Welcome. Mr. Martin.
Yes, members, the crux here of the issue is normally public employees have the right to repay refunds. The difficulty here is Ms. Ross is no longer a public employee and is asking for at least she's not covered by PERA General. She apparently is a school board member and is in the PERA-defined contribution plan, but that does not give her the status of a public employee. She does not have the right under current law to repay a refund, so she's asking for a special authority to repay that prior refund.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Martin gave in his memo, has laid out Ms. Ross's situation of why she took a refund, and that's probably in the memo that says public pension problems of Ms. Ross. There is also, I think, an amendment that has been drafted by staff to this, and both Senator Saxog, myself, and Ms. Ross would prefer that we consider that as opposed to the bill itself.
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA. First, I guess I'd like to clarify with Ms. Ross, this is just for the previous 4 years and 2 months back in the 70s. This isn't for your entire period of service.
This is for the 4 years.
Ms. Ross has 20 years of service credit with PERA and the defined benefit plan. And what she is seeking to repay is 4 years and 2 months of service for which she took a refund back in 1976. The amendment as drafted that would allow any member of the defined contribution plan to repay a refund into the defined benefit plan is problematic for us because there are 559 current members of the defined contribution plan who have forfeited service credit in the defined benefit plan. So we basically look at those individuals and say they are not entitled to a defined benefit because they took their refund, and our notice on our refund application and our brochures is that when you take this refund, you forfeit those rights. And so if we're going to start mixing up the defined contribution, defined benefit issue of that coverage, that's a much bigger policy discussion, I think, that has to be had by the commission, in my estimation. So broadening it to include any DCP member to repay a refund in the DB plan for forfeited service is problematic for us. What you want to do with respect to Ms. Ross, it restores 4 years and 2 months, so it increases her her pension value from roughly $922 a month to $1,147 a month at a cost of $15,700 if paid by June 30th or $16,004 if paid by the end of the year. We used two different dates because it wasn't clear to us in the bill draft exactly when she'd have to pay this. So we just wanted to give a range.
Questions from members? Ms. Vanek, do you think the specific bill sets a precedent that you're uncomfortable with, or do you think this fact situation is such that it does not?
Mr. Chair, with all due respect to Ms. Ross, I think it does set a precedent that we're going to face if this is allowed to go forward.
Chair?
Representative Solberg.
As I understand the amendment, however, there is a second part of that, and that it's narrowly drafted. But it is trying to address, as I understand it, is the fact that Ms. Ross is a member of a school board and is thus part of the group of PERA. But in the second part of this also, this section one is only in effect for that particular person.
No, no, we understand that. I don't, that's not the point, I think. No, no, we understand we can draw a bill like that. It's a question of whether we want to. Is the school board compensated per diem, or what kind of situation does Itasca have?
We're compensated.
Or not, is it the Itasca School District? Which school district?
District 318, Grand Rapids.
Grand Rapids, okay. What kind of school board is that?
Pardon?
What kind, is it paid, or what kind of school board?
We're compensated $2,250 annually.
Regardless of the number of meetings, it's a set amount?
And a $40 per meeting. Per diem.
Okay. So in some senses, it's not a just per meeting position.
No.
Members? Representative Wardlow?
I got a question. Ms. Vanek, you said when you take the refund, there's something on the form that says it's irrevocable after that. You can't. And did Ms. Ross, did you see that part of the form?
That's what I missed, just given my personal circumstances at the time. And it's rather small print. I had contacted PERA in 1997 and in 2000 requesting what my annual payout would be and what it would cost to repurchase my four years of service. And it wasn't mentioned to me that upon my termination of employment that I only had a six-month window. It was always my intention to repurchase, and I understood that the interest was compounded annually. And I was not going to draw my retirement at the time. I intended to leave it sit until I retired. And I missed that there was a six-month opportunity.
Representative Thiessen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, Ms. Ross was a member of our coordinated plan for many years. She left in 76, took her money, came back in, and accrued 20 more years of service, had an opportunity to repay the refund, and she's not, it's not untypical for a member to delay that decision. She then left in 1999 and is now a member of the school board, which allows her to participate in the defined contribution plan. She's earning basically a lump sum benefit there, but would like to also restore the additional credit in the defined benefit plan to give more value to that defined benefit. But the law doesn't allow that. They have to be a member of the defined benefit plan to do so.
Mr. Chair, and the 550 people are people similar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, that's correct.
Representative Solberg and Senator Saxhog, I'm sensing an uncomfortableness on the commission on this one. I think there's a fear that this does set a precedent that we probably will regret. So I think Bedsel's moving that we do not incorporate this bill in the omnibus bill.
Set aside for now.
Set aside for now.
Play it over, but I'm not making a motion to incorporate it. I'd like to just let it play out. So
there may be some other issues here.
There may be some other issues, but
That's the Bedsold motion.
Bedsold's
motion is to set it aside, not incorporate it right now. But I guess he's suggesting there's a possibility if there's some additional information here. Maybe the commission could be convinced.
Not if we have 500 other people.
I'll just say I'm not quite sure what that information will be, but
you never know.
He says he's open. So on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Ross. Representative Hausman, Senator Anderson, number seven.
And we'll take the Skoglund bill next, I believe. And then Gerlach.
Dietrich's here.
Dietrich's here also. Okay. Welcome. Mr. Martin, what do we have here?
Members, this is a situation. The pension fund is the Minneapolis Fire our Relief Association. This is a question of eligibility as a surviving spouse to a survivor benefit from the Minneapolis Fire Plan. The individual is a post-retirement marriage surviving spouse. Historically, with our local police and paid fire, we never used to provide a surviving spouse benefit if someone was not married to the firefighter prior to the retirement of the firefighter. That was changed in the Minneapolis Fire Plan a decade or more ago, and we now permit, after our retirement, marriages to be considered surviving spouses. But there is a minimum time period that marriage has to last. It once was 5 years. Now it's 2 years. In this case, Ms. S.B. Griffin was the spouse of Artis Griffin for 1 year, 9 months, and 20 days, which turns out to be 72 days short of the minimum period when Mr. Griffin died. And Ms. Griffin wants to be considered eligible for a survivor benefit.
And, Mr. Chair, if Senator Anderson and I could add just a few words.
Please.
This, as I understand it from staff, I understand completely the motivation for current law. I think one of the staff members used the term you wanted to avoid marriage of convenience. In other words, someone near death, they marry for the purpose of conveying survivor benefits. We believe this is quite a different circumstance. They, in fact, were together for over 35 years. I think it might have been 37 years. And as these decisions happen, they determined to marry. They are about 2 months short of that two-year time frame. They have a child and a grandchild together and a lifetime of... yes.
No, I'm sorry.
Just take a deep breath. Mm-hmm. And that is why we're motivated to bring it to you, and Senator Anderson would like to make just a few comments as well. I should say, by the way, he was so healthy that he was out for a walk on the day that he died. He was physically active. Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have much to add. I think if we could just let Ms. Espy speak to you about her personal story very, very briefly. Would that be permissible? And I think
Welcome.
She can tell you better than we can.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, anyway, good morning. I'm Roberta Espy Griffin, Artis Griffin's widow since his untimely death, July 4th, 2005. Every day I grieve for the loss of my best friend. I never realized how lonesome I would be. He was pops to me and dad to my daughter and grandpa to our two grandchildren. This was even before we got married. One day we were discussing how our lives were going after retirement. The plans he had to build a house in his hometown of Colleston, Louisiana, were scuttled. He insisted on he wanted to fix up the house we lived in, which had been his home for most of his adult life. With the realization of the longevity of the relationship, he said, "We have been together for over 30 years, and I would not have had it any other way." That's when we decided to get married and please our families and, most of all, please ourselves. I was the one who had always been reluctant due to a previous heartbreaking divorce. Even before our marriage of September 14th, 2003, we had lived as man and wife. We celebrated anniversaries, birthdays, family reunions, vacations, and all the milestones of our daughter's life. Artis and I both maintained a very healthy lifestyle and were conscious of our aging body's health concerns. He had a daily routine of exercises that included riding the stationary bike and 1 hour of free weights. We both worked out the first thing in the morning. The end of June, Artis had a complete physical and was happy with results of his tests given. He had no reason to change his active lifestyle. He was the second youngest sibling in a family of 9 children and the first to die of natural causes. He had longevity on both sides of his family. His mother lived way into her 90s, and so did his father. He had made future plans with our grandson, Randall. When he was 10 years old, they would go on vacation to his hometown of Colleston, where he would teach Randall to hunt rabbits and squirrels. Artis had already purchased 2 beagles, and his best buddy was training and keeping them for him. Every time Randall came to the house, plans were discussed about the trip, and he also included our grandson's best friend. Both of the boys could hardly wait for the 2 years to pass. Both of the children, Randall and his older sister, Carissa, still yearn for his kind way, his great sense of humor, and his wonderful way with children. The day Artis died started out with his normal exercise routine, then his walk in the neighborhood. He sat on the porch, waited for the paper, and then tossed it into me. Not too long after, I heard an emergency vehicle go down the street. I looked out to see where it was going and returned to the house. Soon I started worrying because Pops hadn't returned home, and I was anxious to for him to get ready to watch the Tour de France. He was an avid Lance Armstrong fan. I kept saying, "What could have happened? Where is he? Oh, I hope nothing bad has happened to him." That's when I thought of the emergency vehicle, and I called Regents Hospital to find out if he was the emergency. I knew he had no ID. At first, they wouldn't even put me through to the emergency operator. I explained how worried I was and gave them the location and exact description of him and the clothes he was wearing. I was then told he was deceased and to bring ID with me. The whole thing was a terrible tragedy. No plans had been made. The one blessing was he died instantly, not some horrible struggle with pain and suffering. The survivors are the ones who are blindsided. Artis had won a workman's compensation case against the city of Minneapolis. He could have received a lump sum, but chose to take the bi-monthly payments until he was 67 years old. Within the last 2 years, he had been contacted by his workman's comp lawyer to try for a buyout. He preferred getting the checks until he was 67. He had a little over 3 years to go. He gave me the checks, actually, for the expenses, and I sure could use it now with a $600 heating bill last month. Tonight, in fact, is a special on Channel 4 talking about Excel bills spinning out of control.
I think this is going beyond what we need to know.
All right, but I'm just telling you, I need the cash. The first year within Pops, I've turned the thermostat down to 68. In a summation, all I'm saying is that I provide an artist with the love, care, and friendship we all yearn for. Like Pam Thompson is another one, and she is going to be talking about the letter that Walter Shermer received from their lawyer, talking about the fact that...
I think you don't want to go there. Let's just worry about your bill.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson. Senator Anderson.
That's okay. Just real briefly, I think the key points are that this couple lived together as man and wife for well over 30 years, and I know we don't recognize common law marriages in Minnesota, but from their perspective, they were married and they lived that way, and with the average marriage lasting 7 years or less in this country, I think that's a testament to the fact that this was a real extended relationship. And secondly, there was an issue about the health history, and I just wanted to clarify that because Mr. Martin mentioned that in his really thorough summary here. And as she said, the workers' comp issue was about apparently he had a back injury while he was still active on the force in the fire department. And so that was not something that would have contributed to his untimely death. He didn't have any apparent health conditions that contributed to this untimely death. Everyone was expecting him to live a lot longer.
Okay.
And so there's absolutely no indication that this marriage had nothing to do with that at all. And I don't think there's anyone suggesting that it did.
Kate, thank you. Fund. Someone from the fund want to comment? Mr. Shermer, Mr. Rice?
Some room for you?
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Walter Shermer. I'm with the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association. We've talked about this issue at the board level, and the trustees of the Relief Association refuse to take a position one way or the other. Their commentary is that law is the law, and we'll abide by the law, whatever that law is. It's not something that firefighters do to even appear to go against something that would be beneficial to one of our members or spouses or children or anything like that. So it, as you might guess, this is a very difficult situation for the trustees to be in. So with that being said, what we would like the commission to understand is that there are cost factors that relate to all of these issues, and there are also reasons for those laws that are in place, and we ask that you just look at those situations, and when you make a determination, recognize that there is an impact and on both sides, and that the fund doesn't want to take a position because they don't want to appear to be beating up on widows and orphans. It's really that simple. It's pretty easy to look at the laws and recognize what they are and abide by them and put those rules into place and live by them, and that's what we're going to do. So whatever the commission decides or the legislature decides is what we'll abide by. And that's about all I have to say. I provided some information to the commission staff as to the cost factors related to these items, both items 6 and 7 on the agenda. So that's about all I have to say. Thank you for your attention.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, briefly.
Mr. Rice?
Just to supplement the record, Mr. Shermer did provide the staff with prior correspondence, I believe from me to Ms. Thompson, about just explaining that she didn't meet the qualifications. In that case, the marriage had been in existence a little over a year, and since it had occurred post-retirement, a two-year period was required. Mr. Martin's actuarial estimate that he had in his memo for the cost of Mrs. Roberta's pension of $265,000, our actuary just completed a study earlier this week. It's $282,000 by his estimate, so Mr. Martin's number is very accurate in terms of a rough estimate. And the number for Pam Thompson is $387,000. She's younger than Roberta. Just one other thing to add, that this situation is pretty unique because of the plan design of the Minneapolis Firefighters Relief Association and the automatic survivor benefit in the way the plan grew up. 20 years ago, neither of these marriages would have even been considered because you had to be married before you retired from the department. The plan did go to the legislature initially and get city approval to change the plan design to allow post-retirement marriages. That's a fairly, I think that's unique in the country to allow that. And the initial period was a five-year period that the marriage after retirement had to be in existence 5 years as a way to protect the fund. The memo from Mr. Martin or Mr. Burek described a prior situation where there was a marriage that existed 4 years and 9 months. The legislature did grant an exemption from that, and that resulted in the plan then going down to 2 years for a marriage after retirement. The discussion that we had some time ago on that resulted from going to 5 to 2 years in post-retirement. And then you did deal with the Thompson issue. We feel, at least, or on the Thompson case, that bill came before the legislature several years ago. And in Pam Thompson's case, there was a refund that was eligible in that case of about $85,000. I guess to date she hasn't collected on that. She hasn't requested that the fund actually pay her the refund. And there was legislative consideration. Senator Betzold was involved in changing some laws on that to reach what then was, I believe, thought to be an equitable situation on that case. So I know these issues are, you know, difficult ones for the commission to look at, but I do think it's important to, and the staff has done a good job in providing some of the background, but I think that's all we have to say.
Questions? Minneapolis, want to say anything? Thank you, Mr. Shermer, Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen Lowry Wagner with the City of Minneapolis. As Mr. Rice said, these are very difficult situations, and I think my comments are going to be very similar to what you heard on Tuesday. As a matter of precedent in some of these issues, we do have concerns. We do have concerns about the costs being passed on to the city. With respect, there is a local approval clause in these. The council does not have an official position because this has not been brought to the council. So if it does pass here, it will have to go back to the council for their actions, which we agree with, and we ask that the local approval clause does remain. We do, as the fund, kind of have this broad principle that the rules are in place for reasons, and we support trying to maintain those rules and provide the city with some framework and predictability on these issues. That's kind of our general comments. We agree with the fund.
You what?
We agree with the fund.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just one last point. As a policy thing, at some point there's a line that's drawn here, and it's tough to do that. The commission moved from no benefit marriage after retirement to a benefit with 5 years. Then a situation came up, 4 years, 9 months, and the fund moved it, or the legislature and the fund, I think, in a dialogue moved it to 2 years. I think the suggestion that's on the table or one of the amendments is to a one-year period to accommodate the Thompson situation, which I think a pretty good argument was made that the commission wrestled with that issue 2 or 3 years ago. And I guess the question you have to ask yourself is if you move it from 5 to 2 to 1, what happens? And I mean, I think everyone, Roberta's case is one that's there. It's well stated. But we have a number of members out there for both police and fire. I think both are on a 2-year post-retirement provision now, I believe. The police may still be at 5. And they're not inexpensive. I mean, between the two of them, it's $600,000 approximately if you do it. And that's, while it's small in the relative thing, it's significant, and it also is precedential, and it's also one that could lead to other, you know, cases coming forward because we don't know the circumstance of all the members.
Okay, thank you. Representative Osmond, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rice, if these firefighters had died in the line of duty while they were still working, would they have received, would their survivors had received any pensions?
Yes, they would.
And based upon the common law marriage situation or what?
No, that if they had been, Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, if in both cases that Mr. Griffith and Mr. Thompson were alive and they were married there and died in the line of duty, there's no period of, you could be married a day and come back from your honeymoon, you're married, you die, your spouse would get the pension.
Okay. If Mr. Chair and Mr. Rice, then prior to the marriage, because there's a 30-year relationship, and I assume that a significant amount of that time firefighters were in that relationship when they were on the fire department, but they were unmarried.
No pension. Minnesota doesn't recognize. The requirement in the pension statute is marriage and common law cohabitation relationships don't meet the definition of marriage.
The question that I'm having difficulty with is knowing the risk that a firefighter is at every day, and went to that job every day knowing that the people that he was living with and his family wouldn't have that protection. I don't understand why that would even occur.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osmond, you raise, these are difficult matters in terms of marital relationships, you enter into the mind of the person in deciding whether to marry or not. It is a legal undertaking. It's a very serious undertaking with important ramifications, one being in the pension area. I mean, the status of being married is a lot different than being unmarried, and it's a lot of legal rights and benefits go with it, and a lot of legal obligations go with it, too. If you're married, half of, marital asset, property builds up, half of the assets you have go to a spouse. If you're not married, you don't have that circumstance. So it's a very important line to cross. It's not one you can consider lightly because it has implications.
Do you have to actually designate, if you are married, do you have to actually designate the benefit to your spouse?
No.
Or it's just automatic?
It's automatic.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I'm derelict because every time a situation like this comes up before the commission, we always say that we're going to talk about the situation without personalities or specific situations, but we're going to talk about these laws, this law, and these rules of 1 year or 2 years or 5 years during the interim. And I've always shut up thinking I'll wait for the interim, and then the interims come and I haven't begged or nagged or pushed to have that discussion. And I've always felt that it's really, really necessary that we do have that discussion because there's so many things that enter in. And I did think about it in September. And especially as a result of the bill that we passed last year, with the St. Louis Park situation. And
commission did not pass that.
Right. The legislature passed that without the commission's recommendation.
No, the commission opposed it.
And so that was and without, but nevertheless. And so we've got, at some point in time, we really have to discuss this without a personalities in the situation. That being said, I'm going to nag more, but not now. Right now, I just want to know, in this situation, then did the survivors get his, or the people who he designated, get the money that he put in, or does that stay with the fund then because it wasn't long enough?
He used that money. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, that money was used during his retirement process.
Okay.
Which instance? You're talking about the SB case now?
The SB, right.
For Mr. Griffin, he was on pension law. The provision is a member gets the...
Mr. Griffin, I'm sorry.
Mr. Griffin. Right. Any member has a... their contributions plus interest builds up, and the law provides that when the member retires, there's kind of a drawdown on that, and if he should die before his member contributions plus interest have accumulated, there's money left to the and there's money left. He hasn't taken everything out. There's money left, and it's paid to the estate. In the Chuck Thompson case, there was about $80,000 left. It's still in the fund, and it still will be paid to Pam Thompson when she applies and asks for the money. It's accumulating interest. In Mr. Griffin's situation for Roberta, he had been retired long enough that he'd drawn down that account. I think in both cases, there's a separate benefit that the fund pays from the general fund where a member can designate. Not the pension fund we're talking about today. There's a separate death fund benefit that comes out of the members' account, and there's a, I think both of these women were designated for that account, but that's not the issue.
Okay, so in the Griffin case, the money
he collected
his,
more than he paid in.
And, okay, he collected more than he paid in.
Correct.
So the $282,000 that's estimated would be the cost of this then to the fund.
Correct. According to the actuary.
For Ms. Espy.
Yes.
Okay. With no funds left to contribute to the $282,000.
Correct.
All right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, in this discussion about a couple being legally married versus living together, you know, marriage is documented. On a given date, that's when the marriage started. When it comes to unmarried, how in the world would you ever be able to document that? I can see us sitting here, people saying, well, let's see, I wrote out a check for the rent at a certain date and everything. I think we would be just opening up a whole can of worms here. I just apart from the morality of it, I think with marriage you got a documentation of when that starts. And when it comes to unmarried, it would be so difficult. So I think we better be very careful about making any changes in that matter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So do you want to deal with this first one first? Or do you want to hear what the second one is? Or how do you want to go here? Just deal with the first one? We've actually dealt with the first one in a previous year, in the second one the previous year. So does anybody have anything on this particular one? On the, does it have a number?
Mr. Chair?
Just the -13, Representative Wardlaw.
I'm just...
This is the Griffin bill now.
Yeah, the thought goes through my mind, we keep making laws and then we make exceptions to every law. Is that going to... It's an infinite process.
At least infinite.
Representative Thiessen?
Okay. I'll move past.
Thiessen moves to not include -13. This is the Griffin situation. Discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you, Representative Hausman, Senator. Okay. Zespy Griffin, thank you. Senator Skoglund. Mr. Martin, we have dealt with this issue previously.
Mr. Chairman, you have heard the issue. You didn't take a vote in
okay.
the previous. And I really want to thank the chair and the committee for your willingness to listen to the issue. You've been more than open-minded on it, so I appreciate that.
This is Ed, Mr. Burick.
Members, this is another Minneapolis Fire Relief Association issue where the individual is requesting a surviving spouse benefit. It is another case where the surviving spouse did not meet the definition of a surviving spouse for purposes of Minneapolis Fire Relief Association law, and the individual is asking for a waiver of that to allow the individual to receive a benefit. There has been some discussion of this already, so I'll certainly keep my comments brief. I would remind the commission did handle this previously, and that was back in 2003 when there was a bill for the individual, again, requesting a surviving spouse annuity. The commission did not recommend that to pass. Instead, what the commission did was there was another bill at the time, another Minneapolis Fire bill that provided that organization with an enhanced refund, enhanced death refund, above and beyond the refund permitted in prior law. And Senator Betzolt made a motion to make that enhanced death refund language retroactive to include this surviving spouse to entitle her to that enhanced refund. So the commission has taken some action on this, and because of that, there is some fairly unusual language in the bill which would require the individual, if the individual does take a death refund, to repay that prior to becoming eligible for a surviving spouse benefit to ensure that the individual isn't receiving two benefits when the intention certainly was to provide only one. For those comments, I turn it back to the commission.
Okay, Senator Skoglund or Ms. Thompson?
Mr. Chairman, we want to thank the committee for your actions on that enhanced benefit. That was a very wonderful and decent thing of you to do. Ms. Thompson has not taken that option yet. She would still prefer to be covered by a widow's pension. She was married to Mr. Charles Thompson, a 24-year veteran of the Minneapolis Fire Department. They lived together for 8 years. They wed while he was an active firefighter, and he retired after they were married. Unfortunately, Mr. Thompson died 11 months later after he retired. Current law says that widows who marry employed firefighters are eligible for the benefit after 1 year, but 2 years for retired firefighters, and she fell between that gap that you heard about previously. We're asking that she be considered for the benefit. And again, we thank the committee for the work that you've done previously for her.
Good morning, and thank you for your time. One of the things I wanted to bring up here, and I guess I really have a problem with this. The current rule says that a spouse must be married to the deceased member 1 year prior to the deceased member separating from the fire department, or the marriage must have been in existence for 2 years prior to the member's death. I actually feel, although I'm asking for an exception for myself, I feel that that's discriminating, actually. I mean, if you're giving woman A, you are currently paying that woman who happens to be married while that person is working with 1 year of marriage. You are paying on that. And now you're making the determination that a second woman, her 1 year of marriage isn't as valuable as woman A. So, I mean, I have a year of marriage on top of 8 years living together in a 19-year relationship with this man, caring and sharing and paying expenses and all that type of thing. The other thing is that I have a, since I was here last time, I received a letter. I had asked Walt Shermer, the executive secretary of the Fire Relief Association, if I could appear in front of them and just talk with them. And he pretty much said that he didn't feel that that really would do a lot, you know, much of anything, that they're just going to take the stance, like he reiterated earlier, as to whatever you decide, that's what they'll do. And but he said he would send me a copy of a letter from their attorney that states what their stand is on this. And I guess I'm maybe it's a page and a half. I can either read the whole thing or just go right to the paragraph.
Just do the paragraph you
just
want.
Just do the paragraph. It says, although not applicable, this is from Robert D. Klostner, PA Attorneys at Law. It says, although not applicable to public sector plans,
the this is in our, just I'm sorry. Members, this is in our packet here.
Four pages down
on this this packet. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm in the third paragraph. Okay, it says, although not applicable to public sector plans, the Retirement Equity Act, which governs marital property rights to ERISA, IRSA pensions, provides for a minimum of 1 year marriage duration for survivor benefits. This provision has been enacted to guard against deathbed marriages, which could have the effect of dispossessing other family members who may have cared for the deceased employee. Minnesota courts have recognized the importance of the material relationship as one which provides aid and comfort to the plan member in his or her later years. Scott versus Minneapolis Police Relief Association, et cetera. The Supreme Court upheld the requirement in that plan that a surviving spouse be married to and living with the member at the time of the member's death. The court held that this limitation protected against sham marriages, which mine was not a sham marriage, and ensured that the member would have marital companionship in his declining years. A similar result was reached by the Supreme Court of Nebraska in Worley versus City of Omaha, in the numbers. In that case, the court refused to award death benefits to a widow who had been married to the member for less than 1 year. And I have a year of marriage. This person had less than a year. To the exclusion of the member's child, copies of the cases are enclosed. Now, this is what I find interesting. This is the Fire Relief Association's attorney. I believe that it is incumbent to the board as the plan fiduciary to take a position against eliminating a minimum marital duration, except in those cases where the member dies in line of duty. The marital duration provision was intended to prevent sham marriages, which mine isn't. Its purpose is no less important today. Whether the duration is 1 year, 2 years, or any longer period is less important. Isn't that interesting? They're saying it's 1 or 2 years. 2 years is less important as long as it's 1 year. And that's really all I'm thinking. You know, and I'm not proposing that because that's not my position. I'm asking for an exemption, an exception, for myself. But I'm just speaking of other firefighter spouses who in the future would have the same situation where there currently is. This is actually a federal law, I believe. But they are saying 1 or 2 years. I agree it should be 1 year. I agree to perfect, you know, to prevent against sham marriages. But I have this year, and I think that when you say one woman can have it and another woman can't, you're devaluing my marriage. And, you know, I'm sure my husband doesn't appreciate that, and neither do I. Let's see. The other thing, I guess, it's my understanding that this pension fund is going to be paid out anyway. I mean, these dollars are allocated, unless I'm being misinformed. My husband used to always say, the last person in there is really going to be wealthy, you know, because the money, it's not like I'm trying to have taxpayers pay for me. The money is already there. And instead of 10 people getting it, now 9 people get it. And with Roberta's husband passing away, now 8 people get it, hypothetically. So, I also wanted to say that, you know, we were together for a long time, and if you want to know his intent for me, I have a copy of his will that he had written in 1997, and we got married in 2000, and willing everything to me in my maiden name, which proves that his intent was for me to have this. Now, why did he write a will when he was 47? I'm 49. I have a will written too. So, I mean, I think everybody should do that. I also went out and I've gotten signatures of support. I have 140 citizens of Minneapolis that support my cause, and I have 72 firefighters, of which I actually went to all 19 stations, and Chief Forte had these copies, and he only sent half of them back. So I got 9 out of the 10. And out of the nine that I got back, 72 firefighters wanted me to have this. And I'm going to make an assumption, which I know one shouldn't do, but had I gotten the other 10 back, there probably would have been another 72, which would be 140 firefighter signatures. Some of these are fire motor operators. Some of them are captains.
I think we get the point.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I could have gotten 1,000. I just didn't know where to quit. Other than that, I guess I just think, you know, when you're married, you're married. One day, the day I married him, I assumed all his bills, and I'm having difficulty taking care of all those. I've depleted already a lot of my savings bonds that I had that were supposed to be for my retirement, his retirement, and I don't know. It's had a major effect on me on top of losing him, which is the worst thing. I also think that it's interesting that you punish the firefighter who puts in more time. I mean, if a firefighter is married a year and they're working, and I believe that you can become a firefighter up to age 35, that would mean, and I think to get the pension you have to be 50 or something. So that would be like 15 years. So the guy who puts in 25 years and marries after he chooses to get married later in life, he's being punished. I mean, this is the guy that's come to your house night after night protecting you, each and every one of your lives. I mean, he made a decision to give his life for you every day, and every day I worried about whether he was going to come home or not. On top of the fact that he was a Vietnam veteran and served his time there, I think he would be very disappointed if he found out what I'm going through, to have to appeal to you citizens for this, something that he thoroughly thought I was going to have. We didn't even think about this. We had no clue he was going to be ill. He went in for a doctor's checkup, and he actually went to the Veterans Hospital for post-traumatic stress disorder for Vietnam issues, really, to tell you the truth, and was diagnosed then with a more serious issue, and 46 days later he passed away. So, I mean, I had no clue, he had no clue that he was sick right up until that time. So I just appeal to you to do the right thing and do the right thing from your heart, and not just for me. I mean, for me in this instance, correct, but I think it really needs to be reviewed for all firefighter spouses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Appreciate it, Mr. Senator Betzel.
It may be either for the witness or the fund, but I had made the motion to pick the individual up in the death benefits. What do we know that? You indicate you haven't taken the money. It's in the fund, but what was that amount? Do we know that?
What I would be receiving now?
Yes, because I made the motion that you'd be included in that, and I don't know what, but you apparently haven't taken that money out.
I haven't, and I would receive that. It's, I believe, $82,000.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, it's $86,000 is what I see here.
Okay, I apologize. Stand corrected.
$763.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I want to thank Senator Betzel for doing that.
Representative Osman.
Well, thank you, Chair. And Ms. Thompson, do you, during the time that Charles was on the fire department and he was at significant risk every day, did you realize that if he got killed on the job, you would not have received any protection or any benefits?
I guess I never really thought about it.
You don't think that Charles knew that?
Now, you're saying...
Mr. Chair, he may have named her as a beneficiary on a life insurance policy. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be the same as a workers' comp policy or other form, but he may have done that. I use the example, though, of an employee at Control Data who was killed in an airplane crash, who it was a substantial insurance amount that we had on $250,000. He had been married before, remarried, and he didn't change his beneficiary. And so his first wife got the money and his current wife did not, because we had to go by what he said. So he may have done that.
Okay, thank you.
We don't know the answer.
thank you, Ms. Thompson. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions, discussion? Representative Thiessen?
Make a motion not to include it.
Representative Thiessen moves that, this is dash 13, I guess I had the last one wrong. This is dash 13. This is the Thompson situation, not be incorporated. Discussion.
That you would still be entitled to what?
Yes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted.
Chairman,
Ms. Colgan, thank you.
And especially thank you for the benefit that you voted for Ms. Thompson in your previous action. That was really decent of you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Okay, we have Dietrich, Representative Dietrich. Mr. Martin.
Members, this should be the last
number
one
nine
in your packets. This relates to a Hennepin County employee who is receiving a PERA general plan disability benefit. The individual suffers from a medical condition that qualifies him for the disability benefits. When he terminated his employment with Hennepin County, he had applied for but had not gotten a determination from Social Security. As a consequence, when he applied for his PERA disability benefit, he elected to take a single life annuity. He has now been determined to be qualified for a Social Security disability benefit. That changes his financial circumstances. He, had he known he was going to receive a Social Security benefit, he would have named, he would have taken an optional annuity form and would have covered his spouse, who also has medical difficulties, with a joint and survivor annuity, but was not in a financial position to do that, and now requests the opportunity to revisit that optional annuity election and to be able to select a joint and survivor benefit.
Anything to add?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. I want to thank you, first of all, for hearing my bill today. I have authored House File 2588 on behalf of my constituent, Mr. Stephen Schock, a Hennepin County employee of 24 years. Respectfully, I request that Mr. Schock be given the opportunity to amend his pension benefit selection from single life to survivor benefits due to extenuating circumstances surrounding his original decision. I would appreciate your recommendation, and I want to thank you in advance for your attention to this matter. And at this time, if we may, Mr. Schock would like to explain his unique situation and the circumstances under which he made his original pension decision.
Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and esteemed panel. I can't tell you how nervous I am to be in front of this group, but I'm going to do my best to chronologically explain my situation. I retired from Hennepin County September 1st of 2004 after a 24-year career as an HSR2. For those who don't know what that is, it's just basically your frontline grunt that determines welfare recipient eligibility and ongoing eligibility. I was advised by my physician to retire based on my health, and quite honestly, my tank was empty. There wasn't much left in me anymore, and I had a very short turnaround time in which to retire. I filled out my paraforms, and I had checked in advance with Social Security on how to go about applying for that, and they told me that I couldn't apply until the actual day that I was no longer working. So I did this in conjunction, both at the same time, and got the medical evidence I needed to, et cetera. I did not elect the joint survivor based on the fact that not only did I know not what my income would be, but whether or not I would even have income. I was told just December 1st of 2004 that my para had been approved, and just a month and 10 days later, I was lucky enough to find out that my Social Security disability was also approved. I'm a class 3 heart failure, congestive heart failure patient who you don't want to go into class 4. Those are the transplant people. So I realize that I don't have a real long tenure here. And my wife, excuse me, has some problems due to traumatic brain injury. She's not able to gainfully be employed or care for herself, and she's on a county program for the Caddy waiver and also through Courage Center. I'm just asking that I'm sorry. just want to provide for her as best I can when I'm gone. And had I had all the facts, knew what kind of income I would have, timelines, whether it would be approved or not approved, etc., I would have been able to make an informed decision on whether I could elect for survivor benefits for her. Morally, I don't think there was a choice. I had to elect for her. But the fact that I did find out, and I immediately called Pera to find out if I could get the switched over to the survivor benefits, I broke no timelines. Working in public assistance and service, believe me, I know all about bureaucracy and timelines. And I did everything I could to expedite every matter I could. And I'm very grateful that I got my disabilities approved as quickly as they were. I'm just asking you now to overturn the waiver that would allow me to elect to provide survivor benefits for my wife. Thank you.
Questions? Sarah Betzel.
Just a clarification, Mr. Schott.
Yes.
Your wife, when did she suffer this traumatic brain injury?
August of 2003.
So this was after then you retired then?
Pardon me?
Was this after you retired?
Is that? Oh, no, no. I retired September 2004.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. What was the nature of that injury?
How did it happen?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, just briefly.
She was thrown from a vehicle. And
okay. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Dietrich. Representative Dietrich. PERA. Thank you.
And go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. This again grants an exception. The board's position, and although I believe we've drafted legislation, don't believe that it's been introduced, the board's position is that they'd like to see individuals allowed up to 60 days after the effective date of a benefit to make a change, because there sometimes are circumstances where they have additional information. Although in this case, it doesn't appear that that would have helped if we had it in place, because he was approved in December, but his benefit was retroactive to October 1st of 04, and he found out, I believe he said shortly in 2005, that he wouldn't have met the 60 days in that case. So this really is, it goes back to a discussion we need to have of should we have a time period where people can make a change, but even if you do have that change, will there often be exceptions to whatever time period you set. So I don't really have a position one way or another other than to share with you the board's thinking on when people should be given an option to change.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a cost?
I wonder if we shouldn't set this one aside and have a little more staff work done on this one. So Representative Thiessen moved to set this aside for some further staff work. I'm not clear. Nobody has perfect knowledge when they make these decisions. I'm not clear as to what the extenuating circumstance other than not having perfect knowledge. And maybe you want to add to that, but nobody has perfect knowledge when they make these decisions. Is there something I'm missing here? Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the it boils down to the extenuating circumstances are his illness, his wife's illness, the timeline of how he needed to make those decisions. But I think at the crux of it all was his financial condition at the time that he needed to make the decision.
Yeah.
And so I would say that that's the extenuating circumstances. And then a month and a half later, his financial situation changed dramatically. So I would say he probably made a decision based more on fear as opposed to not being able to afford daily life and caring for his wife, as opposed to based on one set of information as opposed to the information he learned a month and a half later.
Mr. Chair, if I can paraphrase, I believe it's an issue of you take a reduction to provide joint and survivor annuity. Absent the Social Security income, could they afford that reduction? Once the Social Security was approved, they had the additional income and probably viewed it as they could then afford to take a lower benefit from PERA to provide that extended survivor protection.
What's the trigger on the Social Security approval in this instance?
It's just the timing of the process. I think we tend to generally, unless there's question about the nature of the disability in the coordinated plan, we tend to respond or approve disability, permanent and total disability benefits much more quickly than Social Security. I believe you have to be off for a certain period of time, off of work, before Social Security will even consider the benefit. So it's just a timing in the administrative process of whether or not you approve an application. The way they work.
Okay. We're a little short on time. If other members are comfortable to move one way or the other on this, we can do that. I'm not totally sure I totally grasp this yet. Are other members comfortable or not? Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I'm not comfortable because I don't understand the difference in the benefit pay and what it is. And are we talking about, so the money that's been received up to this point is a certain amount and then it would go down, or would we subtract from? I don't get how we're going to financially balance it out. And that was my question. What's the difference in the benefit payouts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the way the bill is written, he would be required to repay to us, and it probably would be through the form of a reduction in the payment to him. The difference in what he received over the time period between when we started to pay him and when he makes the election change. The amount of money that has to be restored depends upon which option he selects. There's four of them under PERA, 25, 50, 75, or 100%. So we've calculated through the end of June of 06 that it, depending upon which option he selects, we will need to recover $1,275 to $4,495, depending upon which of those four options he would select if he's allowed to do this.
Yeah. Representative Thiessen.
Quick question. Is the fund put in different positions based on this decision? Decisions based on this decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the optional annuity form of payment technically is supposed to be an actuarial equivalent. So as if we paid him the highest amount for his lifetime, when we reduce it to cover two lifetimes, we're not supposed to, in essence, be paying out any more over those periods. However, the Minnesota plans do subsidize a bounce-back feature, so there is a little bit of cost to the plan.
Oh, thank you.
Because if she would predecease him, he then bounces back up to his normal annuity amount. So there is a cost in there, but I don't know how to quantify that.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would have happened had he waited for the answer from Social Security?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wardlow, if he really, I think it would have been a matter of him delaying his application process with PERA, and had that occurred, our law says we can pay retroactively to the date of termination of service or 90 days from the date we received the application, whichever is the shorter amount. So if he had delayed beyond 3 months from his termination to apply for PERA, we would not have been able to pay him all the way back to October 1st, but he still would have received payments.
Why don't we set your motion is set aside to further think about that. Okay.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Representative Dietrich, we will put it on the agenda probably the next meeting, but we'll give you a heads up ahead of time about where we think this is at. I don't know that it's necessary that
Mr. Schatz
comes back. I don't think he needs to come back.
Okay.
Unless there's something a member needs to specifically ask, but I think we've covered that. So
thank you very much.
Thank
Senator.
You, sir, for your patience. Members, we're not going to finish these today. But is Gerlach here?
Yes,
we'll do that one for sure. Can you wait on yours?
I think so.
How complex is that one, number 8?
That one.
Okay, we'll wait. Is there somebody here waiting for
you? No, I don't really know.
Is there one here for the number 8 bill, the one that Representative Smith is authoring? Okay, so we're not going to complete that one today, and we're not going to complete number 2 today. And St. Paul should stop and talk to me after the meeting.
Thank you.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Number 5.
I'm here today with Mr. Kevin Mosher from Apple Valley, and he has a situation here with TRA. And I think that he contacted me, and I had him lay out his situation with Mr. Martin. So I think Mr. Martin can probably explain.
We will do that. Mr. Martin.
Members, this has to do with TRA and the MSRS unclassified plan. And it really is a question of whether a transfer of money from one plan to another should be treated akin to a refund or not. Mr. Mosher was a teacher for a good period of time. Then he shifted to the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium. At that time, under a special law, he had the authority to move his TRA money over to the unclassified plan, which is a defined contribution plan. TRA is a defined benefit plan. He did so. He transferred his money to the unclassified plan. Within a relatively short period of time, he shifted employment and ultimately ended up back teaching and has been a teacher since 1987 or thereabouts. And he has his MSRS money has subsequently been rolled to a set of private investments. So he's taken a withdrawal benefit from the unclassified plan. He now desires to have the special authority to take that transfer amount and repay it to TRA as if it were a repayment of a refund. We generally permit repayments of refunds, but technically this is not a refund, a repayment, because it was a transfer between funds and then a withdrawal benefit. That, members, I think gives you the sense of what the factual situation is here. Maybe questions that you have for the constituent involved. I think you're the acting chair.
Representative Tyson. Sorry. Just looking at the chairman. Okay. Anything to add?
Members, there is a document that's being passed out. Mr. Bergstrom from the MSRS plan was kind enough to point out to me that I had gotten the statutory references incorrect, and the A1 amendment cleans them up. There were a couple of instances in the 1984 and 1985 timeframe where transfers from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, principally the unclassified plan, were permitted. I assumed it was the general authorization to make that transfer that was at the heart of Mr. Mosher's problem. As it turns out, it was a separate provision, a separate statute provision that applied only to the educational consortium. And so the reference to the general statute needs to be replaced with the specific special law reference for the MEC statute that applies here.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the technical amendment.
Senator Bedsoe moves the technical amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Senator Bedsoe, ready to go with the whole thing?
Anything to add, or?
If we need to.
Commission members, do they?
No.
No. Okay, ready.
Betzold moves the 356, I guess. No? Nope. Yes. What number is this one?
It's document 368.
368 document, as amended,
yep.
Be incorporated. TRA, sorry.
I'd like to point out that he did take the refund back in 84, transferred the money. The present value of that, if you classify it as a refund, paying both back the employer and the employer plus interest, is $73,995. But if you treat it as a purchase of service, it's $173,810. So, I mean, depends on what your feeling is about if it's a refund or if he's going to be treating it as a purchase of service. I'd also like to point out that at 8.5%, that's less than what TRA would have earned had the money been in there years. We earned about 10.8 during that period of time.
So what's the position?
So what's the fund's preference here?
Well, if you're going to make the fund, if he had left the money there, I mean, there are some points in Mr. Martin's memo that, you know, suggests that this is sort of adverse selection coming back and forth. He went into MSRS, took his money out, presumably reinvested it, so he had the best of all three worlds. First of all, he was in TRA, and he was in MSRS unclassified, and then he was invested in the outside. If it had been a refund, he would have only taken out his contributions, and that's all he'd be paying back today. So it's, you know, I don't know. It's not clear in this case. I mean, clearly, we get the contributions plus interest on both the employee and the employer. That's about $74,000. That's $100,000 less than if you were treating this as a purchase of service.
May I comment? The money, in fact, was not invested when I went to the Minnesota Educational Community Corporation, well, consortium at that time. It was explained to me, and this is from my memory, and it's in, you know, it's like some 20 plus years ago, by the gentleman at that meeting, that my money in the TRA wouldn't be benefiting me. It was just 10 years worth, and that if I brought it over, it would be like I worked for MEC for that 10 years. At that point in time, it was my desire to become a software designer of educational software, and from my point of view, bring computers and the technology into the field of education. I had gotten a master's degree along that line, and it had become a career goal. I didn't know it wouldn't work out during that 14 months, and I won't tell you why, but the corporation at MEC did dwindle from the 250 to 98 employees, and there are reasons why. When I did leave, I had gone through a series of things with my wife, Nancy. She was a Copper 7 IUD victim. Her pelvic inflammatory disease had burned all the cilia off her fallopian tube, which we didn't know at the time, and she suffered an ectopic pregnancy in the fall of 81 and in the spring of 82, and that one nearly took her life, requiring emergency surgery. In her mind at that point in time, she'd lost the ability to conceive, and she found in vitro fertilization was starting up, so we went to Houston. I'm not covered by medical.
I don't know that.
Well, that's where my money went, sir. That when I went to McGraw-Hill with promises of management and I withdrew that money from the TRA, which was a difficult decision, I had medical bills to pay, and it seemed to me at the time that that was a wise thing to do, to withdraw that money and pay those bills, which I did, and without my father-in-law's help, would probably still would be encumbered. So it wasn't invested. I didn't take advantage of the three that the gentleman is talking about. It paid medical bills that were necessary at the time.
Mr. Bergstrom, do you want
to? Getting out of here.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the state retirement system. And I'm here to just talk about the unclassified plan broadly. and maybe in regard to Representative Murphy's thought of studying things in the future. In the unclassified plan, and I'm an example of that, an employee who comes from one fund to another can transfer over their employee and employer contributions plus interest. Now, in this case, there was no interest paid. So in my case, it was very advantageous for me when I took my job to transfer my money over. So I was given that opportunity, and as a fairly young person at the time, it was to my advantage. Now in the unclassified plan, after you get 10 years of service in, now you can switch it back to the general employees retirement, or into our General Employees Retirement Association. And if that's an advantage, I will do that. And I just think it would be good at some point to study the options of these transfers of employee and employer contributions, the options to switch back and forth, because they have a cost. They, you know, it's an ongoing cost to the program. And I just think it would be good to study that in general. So I don't have any specifics, but there are other people in this similar circumstance, and I think it would be good to look at it. We've heard, you know, transfers from IRAP to teacher's retirement. Mm-hmm. We've heard, you know, the IMP issue that's in front of you. You have a lot of these people are given choices, and I think at some point it would just be good to take a step back and really make sure we understand all of those policies, because you're just getting more and more bills. And so I just like to add that.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Bergstrom? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thompson, yeah. Could you join us again? Senator Bedsold.
Mr. Thompson, do you want us to do it or not? I mean, I gotta pin you down here. Good idea or bad idea?
Well, I mean, we'd certainly like to have them back in the plan. I mean, if I take the philosophy this is a refund, then the bill as written, transfer over, said $73,900.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Mr. Thompson.
If you want me, you want a recommendation?
Yes.
Okay, I would, in this case, I would suggest you treat it as a refund, and although technically it's took the money from MSRS, and it's coming back to us, so it's, treat it as a refund. We will gladly accept the $73,000. That's what he took out, plus the 8.5% interest returning.
That makes sense.
Is that what the bill does?
Could I ask a question? Am I allowed to ask a question?
Yeah.
Okay. In a sense, this is going to sound critical. This is all my doing, but in a sense, this could have been solved a long time ago, and I could have put it behind me had I known that this was not possible. Over a number of years, I checked with the TRA continually to find out what I owed. I started a mutual fund specifically for that, put as much as I could aside for it. When I transferred that, when I called the TRA this summer, they said, yes, you can buy back part of that, because I didn't have enough with the 8.5% and all to buy it back. And I transferred what I had in the mutual funds over with the understanding that that would buy back about 7.5 years. And you can imagine how I felt after all this time, only to get a call within the next couple of weeks from the TRA saying that it wouldn't be possible, as explained, which just shattered me. In addition to that, I won't go into what the mutual funds I lost, because there wasn't a way of reinvesting that again after 10 years. So I don't know what I'm exactly saying here, but if I had only known that,
you're not
the
happy
mutual
with TRA
funds would still be there.
All right. Well, I think you're not happy with TRA. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, and you know, I agree. I think that's why we would treat it as a refund. When he came in, 1985, when this happened, there was a special bill to allow the transfer. At that time, it was noted as a refund. Shortly after that, when they looked at the law, they said it cannot be a refund. It was improperly noted on there as a refund. So when Mr. Mosher did come in 1995, the first thing they looked at the ledger, it said refund. They said, oh, you can pay the refund. And then shortly after that, they looked at it and said, under the law, you can't do that. But if the money had been there, you know, 8.5% is the assumed actuarial rate of return. TRA will be made as close to whole as we can be if you simply have transferred the money back plus interest. So I think that's the fairest solution. I don't know how much the difference would have been 1995, but this is less than what we would have earned had the money been in TRA.
Okay, so Senator Betzel, so, Representative Smith, where are we at?
Yeah.
Senator Betzel?
The bill treats it as a refund. TRA is okay with having it treated as a refund, as I understand it. So
it's good to go as is, with the technical amendment.
368 as amended.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, it sounds reasonable. Yes.
Okay. On that motion, all for incorporation. All. Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Aye. Motion adopted. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, members, we're meeting. You'll see at the bottom there, we're meeting Tuesday the 14th. And is that Valentine's Day?
That's Valentine's Day.
Yeah, it is. Is that good? Can we do that or not?
I expect chocolate, Mr. Chair.
I got a court thing that's going to conflict with part of that, so I may have to bail early.
Okay, so Tuesday and Wednesday we'll be meeting.
Okay.
I think
Day, we won't be able to say no to
hopefully we'll deal with some of the larger issues. We hope to get everything kind of wrapped up by Wednesday. Obviously, it's February 15th, so there's a little slippage possible there. But
I'll be in North Carolina.
I think we'll have a quorum. We'll try to take up more difficult ones now. Today wasn't much fun, was it?
It wasn't at all.
It's interesting.
Meeting adjourned.